Right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 1998 PD League Public Lecture at the London School of Economics. My name is Michael Power, and I'm head of the Department of Accounting and Finance here. Before I introduce this evening's distinguished speaker, Professor Baruch Lev, I think it's appropriate to say a little about Leek himself. Percy Dew Leek was a British chartered accountant who went on to run his own firm and became a fellow of the English Institute in 1893. He took a keen interest in all matters relating to the profession and wrote very widely on a number of issues, particularly those relating to asset valuation, depreciation, and goodwill, subjects which remain as controversial today as they were at Leek's time. I know these topics are also close to the heart of Professor Lev's current research interests. Leek was that breed of thoughtful practitioners who had scholarly as well as practical instincts. There was a PD Leek chair in accounting at the University of Cambridge until 1980, and now, I'm pleased to say, one at LSE. When he died in 1949, Leek left a large sum in trust to the Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales for the purposes of supporting accounting education and research. A great deal of this money is presently administered by the Research Board of the English Institute, and I'd like to thank them publicly for supporting this evening's lecture. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this evening, Professor Baruch Lev. Professor Lev's career spans over 30 years at the most distinguished institutions in the world. He was educated at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, qualified as a CPA, and obtained an MBA and PhD at the University of Chicago. He's held appointments at Tel Aviv University and the University of California at Berkeley, and he's acted as consultant to governments and corporations in addition to his academic activities. He's currently Philip Bardet's Professor of Accounting and Finance at the Stern School of Business, New York University, and is also currently Director of the Vincent C. Ross Institute of Accounting Research there. Of his research and teaching achievements, it's difficult both to summarize, so extensive are they, and to exaggerate, such has been their impact. Professor Lev's extensive publication record includes major substantive and methodological contributions over the years in the field of empirical accounting research. He's worked at the interface between the fields of finance and accounting, and he's advanced our understanding of the economic consequences, or lack of them, of accounting policy and practices. He is, in short, someone at the very top of his profession. In recent years, his research has turned towards a subject which is of considerable interest to academics and practitioners alike, the value relevance of intangibles and non-financial information in financial reports. This theme of the value relevance of financial reporting and its decline is at the center of this evening's presentation. So without further ado, I'd like you to welcome the presenter of the 1998 PD Leek Lecture at the London School of Economics, Professor Baruch Lev.
Having just heard that my career spans over 30 years, I just realize how old I am. But anyway, it's a pleasure to be here. Good evening to all of you. The great German poet Goethe, as far removed from accounting as one can be, nevertheless commented on accounting in his book Wilhelm Meister as one of the finest inventions of the human mind. And indeed, if you think about it, a measurement system that was developed over 500 years ago and whose fundamentals didn't change much over that time must be an incredible invention. Few innovation can match this kind of resilience. But it seems to me that this resilience, or if you want, lack of accounting surviving for so long, is quickly running out. And what I would like to do with you, share with you for the next 60 minutes, is some evidence that supports this contention. The reasons, or the main reasons, I think, that caused the loss of usefulness of accounting information or financial reports. And then if we'll have time, we'll get to the Tolstoyan questions of what's to be done. With respect to the loss of usefulness, lots of casual evidence, casual observations. You talk to users of financial reports, at least in the United States. Most of them will tell you that usefulness decreased significantly. This led the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants in the early 90s to set up the Jenkins Committee. Jenkins is now the chair of the FASB. To examine financial reporting in the year 2000, and indeed one of the major conclusions that they reached based on extensive discussion with financial analysts, fund managers, and others was that usefulness of financial reports is quickly going down. It also led the AICPA a couple of years later to set up the Bob Elliott Committee on Auditing on Insurance Services, which was came up with the same conclusion. And of course, it's not only committees. People are voting with their feet. There is, to some extent, I don't want to exaggerate, but to some extent, there is a flight from accounting. Just evidence the incredible popularity of systems like EVA, Economic Value Added, which is undoing many things that accountants do. For example, they capitalize R&D expenditures, they charge earnings for cost of equity capital, evidence a great popularity of the various balanced scorecard, which is an augmentation, modification of accounting information. So we have casual evidence of problems with this information. But you didn't ask me to come here to talk about casual evidence. I would like to share with you some scientific evidence. And it basically comes from a methodology which became very popular in finance research, in accounting research. It goes by the name of event studies, association studies. The idea is that if a message, an information item, is very useful, then people are using it. And if you observe what people do, then you can draw inferences about the usefulness of this information. So, for example, if you look at if your audience are investors in capital markets, if you look at changes in stock prices around the announcements of financial reports, then if the changes are large, it means that financial reports provided lots of information, there was lots of surprise in them, and people acted by changing their portfolios. If, however, a piece of information comes out and there is hardly any reaction or very little reaction, that's an indication that the information content of this message wasn't very large in this case. There are, of course, other methodologies, other approaches. You can go and ask people whether they find some information useful or not, but that's quite a robust, objective type of methodology, and that's what many finance and accounting researchers apply to. Problem is that I'm losing. Okay. And what I have here can you see this? You're probably not. Well, it's in the paper. So that's one of the graphs in the paper. What we have here is, over the last 16, 17 years, a statistical measure. You don't have to be an econometrician to understand it. It's basically a statistical measure of association between reported earnings and stocks' rates of returns, changes in stock prices. And as you can see, there is a very dramatic decrease in the association. And it goes to a very low level. The last year that we looked at was 1996, which is quite a strong evidence that the information, in at least in earnings, is less and less associated with what gets investors into acting, in this case. Some people look at these data and say, okay, you know, we are all aware that earnings have all kinds of problems, huge restructuring charges, and other things. The solution is cash flows. So we repeated the same thing for cash flows, the same methodology. And the results are not very different. That's the association between operating cash flows, again, done every year from 1980 to 1996. And you basically see the same sharp decline over time. And the reason why it hits cash flows almost as strong as earnings will be clear when I talk about the main causes. Some people say, well, it's just earnings, cash flows, there is a balance sheet. Let's look at book value, net assets on the balance sheet. Book values and earnings became popular in the Olson type model, and I understand that he was here last year. So we looked at earnings and book values, a slightly different picture, flat for a few years, but then you have the very sharp decline that you saw before. This is really shocking. I mean, come to think about it, I'm somewhat surprised that you are not shocked, but come to think about it, how can it be? How can it be that in markets which crave for new information, which new information systems are prospering, think about Bloomberg, for example, just coming out a few years ago and now rivaling Reuters, a market which is so tightly regulated, the Financial Accounting Standards Board in the United States is close to, 150 statements by now. If you think about it, financial reporting is probably the only area in which regulation is constantly tightened. Most other areas, regulation are either completely thrown by the wayside or significantly relaxed, perhaps with the exception of environmental regulation. Financial reporting is really the only area in which you get layers over layers. I'm not critical about it at all, but I just want to point out the phenomena. You get layers over layers of regulation. So you have investors which crave for information. You have tightly regulated regulation around this information. You have constantly increasing monitoring of the information by more and more sophisticated financial analysts, institutional investors, which express strong demand for timely, for relevant information. And despite all this, in this case. That's really, I would say, surprising, some extent disappointing. There is clearly the demand there, but the supply for timely, relevant information is not keeping up with demand. And as I said before, it's my contention that the accounting system no longer is doing the job, not across all industries, but in large, important, advanced, fast-developing industries. And that's what causes this decline. In a word, the reason for the decline is change. Firms all over the world, but particularly in advanced economies, firms are transforming themselves, changing in an increasing rate. And the accounting system just is unable to reflect in a timely, relevant way the consequence of change. Now, I don't want to be that esoteric. Let me give you quickly three examples. First one comes from a major change driver, agent of change, and that's deregulation. It comes from deregulation of telecommunication in the United States, which I'm quite familiar with it, having done extensive consulting to local telephone companies, the regional telephone companies. Up to the late 80s, the regulatory setting in the United States over telephone companies and electrical utilities, the same, was basically aimed at assuring these utilities a fair rate of return, a rate of return that investors will be happy with, which of course makes these entities riskless and keeps the value of assets intact. If someone assures you a rate of return, a fair rate of return, what investors will demand from now to eternity, this assures the value of the asset. And this was the regulatory setting for many years. This was called the rate base regulation. Late 80s, beginning 90s, this regulatory setting was completely scrapped. Competition was gradually allowed in, markets open to the local telephone markets. And the whole regulatory setting was changed into an incentive-based type of setting, no longer assuring a rate of return, no longer assuring values of assets. Capital markets reacted immediately to that, to some extent with alarm, because here you have entities, they were all public corporations, public in the American type of sense, with stocks in the stock market. They were all public companies, which all of a sudden were open to severe competition with the likes of MCI and AT&T. So higher risk, higher competition. Stock prices went down quite significantly, lagged significantly the general increase in the 90s in the U.S. market. So investors react to the deregulation quickly. The accounting system didn't do anything, just didn't do anything. For years, the only reaction was the change in revenues, which was very, very mild due to the competition. And then 5-6 years later, in 94, 95, 6 of the 7 regional telephone companies, they usually are called baby bells, wrote off, one shot, $26 billion of assets. Billion with a B, realizing finally there was a sharp decline in the values of assets due to the deregulation 5-6 years later. This was a complete non-event in the capital markets. Investors didn't react at all because all the reaction took place years earlier, and the accounting system just reacted, woke up very late. This caused an almost complete disconnect between financial reports, balance sheet, income statement, where depreciation was based for years on the old values of assets, inflated values of assets, complete disconnect between financial reports and what happened in capital markets, which of course is a major reason for this decline of association between financial information and what happens in capital market. That's deregulation. Our second example comes from a second major change agent, change driver, and that's competition, which has a huge effect on firms, particularly global competition. Firms constantly restructure themselves. The accounting, it's reflected in the accounting by huge restructuring charges, which again cause a disconnect between capital markets and financial reports. That those huge restructuring charges, sometimes in the billions of dollars, sometimes repetitive. AT&T had six restructurings in the last 10 years, each time writing off billions of dollars of assets. Financial reports, of course, show huge losses, relatively low book values. Capital markets usually react positively to restructuring because capital markets are forward-looking, and restructuring is a sign that finally management came to terms with the problem. Again, a disconnect. The third and most important change driver of all is, of course, innovation. Firms constantly change themselves, change the way they produce things, change the mix of products. And this is mainly done through heavy investment in intangibles, in research and development, in brand, franchises, human resources. Again, the accounting system here reacts very quickly in a biased manner in expensing immediately all those all those investments, leaving all the benefits to be recorded in the future, which causes an incredible bias, causes a conservative bias at the beginning. Earnings are substantially lower than what economic earnings are. And future earnings are substantially higher than what economic earnings are because they come without any burden or with only partial burden of the cost. Most of the costs were already expensed in the past. Managers, of course, love it because it inflates rates of return in the future. But it is a very disturbing bias, and again causing a disconnect between what happens in capital markets and what the financial reports indicate. This, of course, has an effect. I showed you the cash flows before, has an effect not just on earnings, has also an effect on cash flows, because cash flows also reflect the immediate so-called expensing of intangibles. These are cash outflows. But accounting earnings was supposed to correct for this problem of cash flows. And of course, in this case, it does not correct. It basically does the same thing. What's common to all the change drivers that I mentioned is that they seriously disrupt the matching, the periodic matching of cost and revenues, cost and benefits, which is the backbone of the accounting measurement system. Both of measuring income, measuring earnings by matching periodically cost and revenues, and of course measuring assets, because assets, as you all know, are the unexpired expenses. So this serious disruption of the matching of costs and benefits by change, whether change is due to deregulation or competition or innovation, is the major reason for this significant decrease in the relevance, in the usefulness of financial reports. It doesn't have a devastating effect in all industries. Accounting basically does the job for stable enterprises, for stable entities. That's what it was designed to do, and that's what it continues to do reasonably well. So for banks, for retailers, transportation, heavy industry, financial reports are continuing to do a reasonable job. Where they fail is where change takes place. And that's in the high tech, that's in the services, and the larger the rate of change, the larger the failure of providing useful information. Just to give you an indication of the magnitude of this problem, let's have a quick look at tangible and intangible investment that's in the United States over the last 25 years, annual investments. The top line is investment by the manufacturing sectors in property, plant, and equipment. It's the largest group of tangible investments. The bottom line is investments or expenditures. These are not recorded as investments by the accounting system, but annual expenditures on intangibles. In the United States, a very large part of it, this comes in 96, this is about $210 billion. A very large part of it, 150, 155, is research and development, which is, of course, the main reason that propels, or the main driver that propels the economy. And although it's not separately reported, I have estimates, or I included estimates for investment in brands and investments in human resources. But what this shows is that at least in the United States, investment in intangibles now matches and probably will surpass very quickly investment in tangible assets, in things that you can touch and keep. And despite this the magnitude, the accounting treatment, of course, is vastly different. All these investments are immediately expensed. No matter what the prospects are of these investments, they don't appear on a balance sheet, causing ridiculous things like a market-to-book ratio of Microsoft of 15 to 1. 15 to 1, the balance sheet reflects about 6% of the value of the company. But more seriously, it distorts earnings, as I indicated before. You want to know why? This is taken from FASB statement number 2, the statement which mandates expensing of all R&D in the United States. And this is justification. Justification is, those of you who cannot read it, I'll read it aloud, a direct relationship between research and development cost and specific future revenues generally has not been demonstrated, even with the benefit of hindsight. Now, I don't know how you can demonstrate anything without the benefit of hindsight, but that's aside. For example, three empirical research studies which focus on companies in industries intensively involved in research and development activities generally fail to find a significant correlation between research and development expenditures and increased future benefits as measured by subsequent sales, earnings, or industry. Can you imagine the research director of Merck, the large pharmaceutical company, which spends $1.3 billion a year on R&D, hearing that there is no relationship between the $1.3 billion and anything in the future? It's a complete waste of money. I mean, this is really a joke, this thing. I tried to get the three studies that they quote. Two are not published, I think for good reasons. And one is a reasonably good study, but it's based on a sample of 10 companies in the 50s, where most, it's not a joke, where, of course, most high-tech industries that are thriving today, like biotechnology and software, are not even in existence there. But nevertheless, this is the justification, not the only justification. There are, of course, reliability issues and others. I don't want to belittle and ridicule this thing. But this appears as a major justification for the immediate expensing of R&D. So let me pause here for a moment just to recap, and then I'll continue. What I was basically talking about is starting with the main change drivers, which are innovation, competition, legislation, this is deregulation, other types of legislation, which lead to increasing rate of change affecting businesses, whether these are new products, new processes that come out of process R&D, or corporate restructuring, or opening of new markets, like in the case of the telecommunications company, which lead to a loss of usefulness of financial information, mainly because of the mismatch of revenues, costs, misstatements of book values, and a very biased reporting of profitability. And again, I mention it because there's so much misconception about it. I get from time to time calls from reporters. They said, you talk about capitalization. We called Mr. X, CFO of company Y, huge high-tech company. This person said, A, that you don't understand anything, and B, that expensing intangibles is conservative. And that's, of course, a misconception, as I mentioned before. Expensing intangibles is conservative only for firms with a very high rate of growth of investment in intangibles. This can be shown mathematically, but I won't bore you with this. It's also intuitive. So in those enterprises, and these are usually young companies in young industries in which the growth rate of investment intangibles, whether it's R&D or product development or brands, or customer acquisitions, like in the case of cellular companies, when the growth rate is very fast, and it has to be very fast, then, of course, when you expense the intangibles, you get a conservative reporting of earnings, and particularly of return on equity, return on assets. However, for firms with a low growth rate of investment in intangibles, and these are all the giants, these are the Mercks of the world, and I talk about U.S. companies because I'm familiar with them, the Mercks of the world, the Hewlett-Packards of the world, the Intels of the world. You look at the growth rate of investment in R&D, it's extremely low, 8%, 9%, 10%, well below the return on equity of these firms. For these companies, expensing is aggressive. They all inflate their reported profitability by expensing. And you can see it intuitively. The intuitive reason for this is that when you expense all these investments, then the numerators of return on equity, return on assets, are very small. They just reflect the tangible assets, which is a very low level of investment for these companies. The numerators, of course, reflect the benefit of these investments. So they provide inflated profitability. Managers are happy with this. That's why managers don't want any change. One of the reasons. Any change in accounting rules concerning intangibles. They are happy with portraying a much better profitability situation than they usually have. Except that they are in trouble. In 1993, when President Clinton started his onslaught on pharmaceutical companies, which was a preparation for the healthcare reform, which was then aborted. He went on TV and said that drug prices are extremely high. Look at the profitability of drug companies. Obscene. 60% return on equity for Merck. I got a call, I was in Berkeley at the time, I got a call and a request by the large pharmaceutical company to provide a study which will estimate the true profitability of these firms. Well, they knew it's substantially lower than what they reported, but then the danger passed and they continued with it. So we have significant problems with the information which is released to outsiders, which of course is quantitatively picked up by this sharply declining association that we started with. The big question, of course, is here. I would say, who cares? So the top three boxes, I think, are established. At least in my mind, they are established. But the question is, what are the harmful consequences of this? Some people say, well, you know, let accounting die. Investors are smart, investors are astute, everyone uses this concept of efficient capital markets. Very few really understand it, but it's a nice cliche. Markets are efficient, investors can see through the numbers, there is no problem. They even use, I even heard people using the very large market-to-book ratio as an argument that investors know how to value companies. Now, we have evidence, it's just emerging, but we have already evidence, and I'm not going to discuss this in detail with you today because I don't have time for this, that there are harmful consequences. Investors don't know. And if you ask yourself, how could investors know? How could investors know what goes on within a drug company, a software publishing company, when they never ask any questions? I mean, I'm consulting to a sizable number of high-tech companies, and one of the first things I do when I come and talk with the scientists there, I ask them, how many financial analysts did you see in the last 2-3 years? Are they coming talking to you? And invariably, the question is zero. Zero. When they come to visit companies, they talk to the CFO. If they are lucky and influential, they also get to talk to the CEO. In this case, they never talk with the technology people because mostly they don't even understand the technology. So how can investors know? And indeed, the evidence that we have, and I say it's not as solid as the beginning, it's just emerging. The evidence that we have is that investors indeed do not know. We have studies that show that the mispricing of stocks is a function, among other things, but a function of the level of R&D. The more intensive the firm is in R&D, the larger the mispricing. We have studies that show that the spread between the bid and the ask, and I hope I'm not getting too technical here, which of course determines the cost of capital. That's the importance of this thing. Determines the cost to the investor, and in turn, the cost of capital to the company, the bid-ask spread, is a function of R&D intensity, in this case, again, among other things. We have evidence that shows that volatility of stock prices is a function or is related to intangibles intensity of the company. Almost every day you see, read the Wall Street Journal or Financial Times, and you see a high-tech company announces a mild earnings disappointment. Just a mild one, stock price is cut by 30%. 30%, 40%. And you ask yourself, how can it be? I mean, this is madness in this case. We are talking about solid companies. How can the total value of the company be cut by 30% because they missed slightly earnings expectation for the next quarter? And one of the reasons, I don't say the only one, but one of the reasons is that investors don't know sufficiently about the company and about the product and about the research and about what really goes on. So they naturally latch on to something that they think they understand, and that's earnings. You have one signal, and then this becomes incredibly sensitive. The price then becomes incredibly sensitive. And studies show that price sensitivity to earnings, to other types of information, is also a function of intangibles. So we have some evidence that this chain ends up with harmful consequences to the economy, to firms, if it has an effect on cost of capital, which leads me to the last part of my talk, to the question of what's to be done. Now, one solution is to give up on accounting. Became recently a very popular solution, even among accountants, to say that's the best that we can expect from accounting system. It's an inflexible, it's an old, tired system. We have to go beyond it. And that's this call for more and more non-financial information. Surprisingly, even the Ed Jenkins committee that I mentioned before, and Ed Jenkins, as I mentioned before, is now the chair of the FASB, one of the major conclusions of this committee was a call for firms to provide more and more non-financial information. Now, to me, on one hand, it's of course fine. Anything that provides information to outside is great. I'm not going to argue against it. And anything that provides employment to consultants is also good. And this is almost the full employment act to consultants. Everyone is clamoring with a new balanced scorecard and a new EVA system. I mean, it's the rage. So I'm also benefiting in a small measure from it, so I've nothing against it. But I just want to point out that this is not going to solve any of the accounting problems. Okay, it's basically deserting the battle in this case. Now, some people say, who cares about accounting? I think we should care. First, all of us accountants definitely should care, because that's what we do and that's what we teach. But even non-accountant, I mean, we are talking about a system that, with all the problems that it has in certain areas, is an incredibly efficient system. I mentioned at the beginning that it survived for 500 years. It's a language that is an efficient language. We understand this language. We don't understand non-financial measures. Okay, every consulting firm has a different way of computing economic value added, EVA. There is no way to compare these things. But there is a way to compare earnings. and cash flows and book values. Even with international differences, though somehow people manage. All those non-financial measures don't have the consistency and don't have the integrity of accounting measures. I mean, there is incredible integrity in the accounting system, in this old bookkeeping, double entry notion. Everything is recorded, everything is reflected there. So in my book, the non-financial measures may be at best a partial solution, definitely not a major one. I'm going to talk briefly about two proposals, and you'll find them in the paper at greater length, detail. The first one is capitalization of intangibles. It's an extension of a practice which is now applied in very limited circumstances in the United States, only applied to, by FASB Statement 86, only to software development companies. In other countries, it's more. And the second one, which is more radical, restatement of financial reports. But basically, let me talk very quickly about... Let me start with the capitalization. In a moment, my inability to draw even simple things. But when I talked about change and the main change driver in tangibles, and the effect on the usefulness of financial report through the mismatch of costs and revenues. Basically, what I had in mind is that expenses are recorded immediately, benefits are left to the future, unencumbered by the investment, so serious biases at the beginning and later on. And capitalization, of course, is just a change of matching costs with revenues, applying, and this to the benefit of students here, applying to intangible assets the same principle that is applied to tangible assets. I know the immediate reaction to capitalization is, how can you capitalize, how can you recognize as asset something that is highly uncertain, and most R&D expenses at the beginning are highly uncertain, and I don't dispute this thing. And that's why I would like to say a word about capitalization. Capitalization is not just adding the expenses. I gave a talk at Wharton, University of Pennsylvania, a couple of months ago. And I was harassed by a faculty member there, and it took me about 10 minutes to understand that he does not understand what I mean by capitalization. He thought that capitalization is just adding all the expenses. And he kept harassing me that this is in the income statement. So, no, everyone who wants to capitalize can capitalize. What are you talking about in this case? Of course, that's not capitalization. By capitalization, I basically mean What is proposed in the International Accounting Standards Committee, and we have Sir Brian Carlsberg here, who is mainly responsible for that. What is proposed in their exposure draft on intangibles? And the two, if I understand it, the two main criteria have to do with what to capitalize and when to capitalize. What to capitalize is you capitalize investments, expenditures on intangibles that clear separable streams of benefits can be attributed to. If you cannot identify benefits, identifying benefits doesn't mean that you have to predict them precisely, but if you cannot identify benefits, cash flows coming from a product development, a software, a drug, anything, then there is nothing to capitalize in this case. That's why, you know, people from time to time ask me, you know, how about capitalizing human resource investment? I have some problems with this, because even conceptually it's not clear what are the benefits that accrue to corporations in a non-slave society investing in human resources. But most of the investment in intangibles, so most of the products that are coming out of this, have clear attributable benefits to it. So this is the first criterion. The second criterion is that you start capitalizing, not from the beginning. At the beginning, it's really highly uncertain. Statistics that I've seen is that one of 10 drugs succeeds. You start capitalizing when you have some objective evidence that at least from a technological point of view, you have a feasible product. This is the criterion of the FASB Statement 86, the statement that mandates capitalization of software development costs in the United States. When there is a pilot study, a working model of the software, you start capitalizing from this point. So attributable benefits and an objective measure of at least technological viability, this in my mind is sufficient resolution of much of the uncertainty, not complete one, but much, and which will warrant capitalization. We have strong empirical evidence, and it's referenced in the paper that you have, mainly based on this laboratory study of software capitalization in the United States, and it is a laboratory study because it's the only industry which capitalizes, and not all firms in the industry are capitalized. Some minor firms like Microsoft don't capitalize, but most of the others do. We have strong evidence that the capitalized values are highly associated with stock prices, with stock returns, with future earnings. And it of course makes sense, because by capitalization, if managers are honest, by capitalization they impart significant information to capital markets. They basically tell capital markets what part of the total expenditures on intangibles succeeded, at least from a technological point of view. A drug that passed a clinical test, a software program that is feasible. We have evidence from telecommunications, cellular companies, that investors undo what accountants do. Accountants write off all the customer acquisition costs, which are huge in cellular companies. When you buy a cellular phone in the United States, you don't know it. But when they hook you up with the operator, with the phone company pays the retailer a commission of between $250 and $350. This is immediately expensed. All the firms are on an incredibly fast growth trajectory, and will be for a long period of time. The penetration rate in the United States is about 12% now. So you get a perverse result in this case. It's not only that accounting is meaningless, accounting is perverse. Because the more successful the company, successful in the sense of increasing the franchise, of getting customers, the larger the losses in this case. Because the large cellular companies in the United States add millions of subscribers per year, and if they pay $250, $350, these are expenses in the hundreds of millions of dollars, which, of course, make a joke of the entire financial report. AT&T acquired McCaw Cellular, the largest cellular company at the time, in 1994, paid $14.5 billion. McCaw, its an entire 10 years existence, didn't show a cent profit in this case. Nevertheless, had this market value, and people say that this is the best acquisition that AT&T made ever. So there is, I think, a good case, in principle, empirically supported for capitalizing some intangibles. And as I said, I would follow the exposure draft of the International Accounting Standards Committee. There is, of course, as Sir Brian will testify, there is huge objection to this. I saw the comment letter of the SEC. Full with alarming expressions. Capitalizing intangibles will contaminate the financial report, will harm the integrity of the financial report. It's beyond me. How can something that you know how it was done and you can undo it by just subtracting one number, how can such a thing destroy the integrity of financial report? Okay? Let me be specific. If a firm capitalizes part of the R&D, they of course disclose it fully. If you think that that's not what they should have done, if you suspect managers that they are playing games with you, just undo it. Just subtract the capitalized number from earnings, and you have earnings under full expensing. How can you be worse off? And the first lesson that you study in information theory is that more information cannot have a negative value, unless it's very costly, of course. Because at worst, you just ignore the new information. That's it. And investors are doing it. The largest web server, America Online, some of you may be familiar with it. I'm now involved as an expert witness in a huge litigation against them. For 2 years, capitalized their customer acquisition costs. Financial analysts were vehemently against it. And practically all of them said this is a travesty, they shouldn't do it, and provided an adjustment. So you had a table which said, here are the reported earnings of America Online, we subtract the capitalized amount from it, here are the adjusted earnings. How can this harm the integrity of the financial report? This is beyond me. Capitalization, of course, will, if it's done honestly, if it's done the right way, it will augment many of the problems that I mentioned before. Not all of them, of course, but it will do nothing to the problems of which arise from deregulation, for example. But many of the problems, it will restore some sanity to the matching or the mismatching of costs and benefits. It will provide intangible assets. It will present intangible assets on the balance sheet, will allow investors to compute some reasonable return on investments, which of course now they cannot. I mean, a return on equity, a return on asset of a firm which is intensive and intangible, it's completely meaningless when only the tangible assets are reflected there. The second proposal, which I would like to take about 10 minutes to discuss, is, I think, more radical. I'm going back to the International Accounting Standards Committee exposure draft on intangibles that I mentioned already several times, which I'm all for. But Section 50, let me read you what it says. It says, costs incurred to acquire or generate an intangible item that were initially recognized as an expense by the reporting enterprise should not be recognized as part of the cost of an intangible asset at a later date. Which means that when the product, the project, whatever you are developing, got into a stage in which, as I mentioned before, some kind of an objective feasibility test has been established. You start capitalizing from this point, but whatever was expensed before should be left untouched in this case. And my question is why? Why, when you realize that you made a mistake. And I am cautious here. It's a special type of a mistake. It's not a mistake at the time. At the time, it was very uncertain. But looking backward, given hindsight, given new information, this is a mistake. Expensing of something which is going to be a product is clearly a mistake. Why leave it as it is? Why not restate the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years of financial reports, capitalizing in this case these expenses, which of course will show, if these expenses are large, will show a different pattern of earnings, different growth, different pattern of book value. The only reason that I can come up with is that with financial report, history doesn't matter. Whatever was published in the past apparently had its impact and now goes to oblivion. And so history really doesn't matter, which brings me to a very brief re-examination with you of the nature of financial reports, nature of accounting information, in the perspective of history, which happens to be one of my hobbies. Financial reports are historical statements. That's exactly what they are. The history of the firm, the performance, the assets of the firm, the last quarter, the last year, the last 5 years. It's a very bizarre history. It's history which expressly prohibits any revision. It's not only in this, exposure draft. Generally accepted accounting principles prohibit any restatements of financial reports, at least in the United States, with one exception that you made a blatant mistake in this case. And then you admit the mistake or fraud or something and you restate. My question is, what is the difference between a mistake and realizing that the facts are different as time goes on? As time evolves, you get new facts. Isn't it a form of realizing that you made a mistake in the past? I am focusing on this issue because what I see as the major objective of financial report or financial information. Most people, when they think about financial reports, the objective of financial report, they think in terms of imparting new information to the market, new information to investors. Well, the value of this new information is minuscule, And I can show you again the graph that I started with. This is about R square is just a measure of association of about 5-6%. This basically says that differences in reported earnings, and these are unexpected earnings, they're already adjusted, to some extent adjusted to expectations. Differences in unexpected earnings across firms account for about 5% of the differences in stock returns of companies. A minuscule amount of information. And it's going to decrease, even this one. Because one of the major developments of capital markets is that more and more information is shared by managers before financial reports are coming out. The whole name of the game is to decrease the surprise in this case. So firms are communicating with financial analysts so that they'll adjust their earnings forecast. Firms are providing, practically all of them in the United States, are now providing pre-earnings information. All of it makes the new information, the new content in earnings or in the financial report in general very, very small and going to decrease. In short, financial reports are not timely. They don't provide much information. And you ask yourself, so what are they doing? And the major objective of financial report, which I find very little really understanding of, and it was pointed out to me in one of a presentation I made to the FASB a couple of years ago, when someone got up and said, Baruch, we agree with you, we lost the battle on timeliness, on new information, but you and all your colleagues, the researchers, completely ignore the major objective of financial information. The major objective is to provide a rich context, a rich mosaic within which any new signal, whether it comes from management, whether it comes from financial analysts, can be interpreted. This is the value of history. The famous historian Clark, who gave the Oxford lecture, which I'm starting here in 1981 in history, talked about lessons from history. And the main lesson he said is that history has no predictive value whatsoever. Yeah, despite what people think, it has no predictive value. because the structure of history is so rich that you can prove anything that you want. And he goes through a series, if I had time I would walk with you, but I don't. He goes through a series of beautiful examples how you can prove that appeasement, for example, worked in the past by some historical cases and didn't work in the past, like in the case with Nazi Germany. How war against terrorism sometimes was effective, sometimes was not effective. And a whole series of things. So it doesn't have much of a predictive value, as we all know. But is it completely relevant? Of course not. What history gives you is this rich context, rich mosaic, within which any new development can be interpreted. So if I cast this in the mold of financial reports that I'm talking now, if I have 5-10 years of financial reports of a company, and I find out that the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration in the United States, approved a drug, which is a monumental event in for drug companies. That's what creates value, FDA drug approval. How do I, not knowing anything about the scientific aspects of the drug, how do I act? How do I value this new development based on the past? I look at the past performance of the company, how successful they were in past drug development. Same thing with corporate restructuring. A new corporate restructuring is announced. What is it? A good news, a bad news is if it's AT&T, it's bad news because they already had 7 of those or 6 of those and they all failed. If it's a company that succeeded in restructuring, great news in this case. Use of derivatives. I want to go out of for a moment on the intangible thing. Use of derivatives. Is it conducive to the firm's operation or not? How do I know? I know if I have a rich mosaic of the past, and that's, to me, is a major, or perhaps the major objective of a financial report. It's not just the small sharing of new information. Now, if this mosaic of information, the historical perspective, if this is important for the users of financial information, revising history is incredibly important in this case. And this prohibition on revising history, which is so rooted in gap, doesn't make any the decisions will have to be made, some guidelines, what will cause a revision, what will not cause a revision, some materiality standards, the things that we are used to in accounting framework. But the concept is, to me, a very operational, practical way of dealing with change, which runs across all the themes that I have taught. When change occurs, whether it comes from deregulation or competition or product innovation, it's highly uncertain. And I somehow sympathize with the concerns of both managers and auditors that this cannot be immediately recognized as an asset. Now time goes by, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. Most cases, much of the uncertainty is being resolved. Once this uncertainty is being resolved, the drug is approved, a software product is working, you go back, you restate the financial report. You enrich the environment. You provide, in most cases, a very different pattern of earnings, for example, which is of great importance, particularly to investors, whether the firm has a momentum in earnings, positive momentum, negative momentum. There are momentum funds which are based on earnings momentum. This is going to change the pattern of earnings in the past. It's going to change the pattern of assets in the past. And it's also, of course, going to put assets on the balance sheet that will make return on equity, return on asset computation much more reasonable. And it's I think, a reasonable compromise between concerns with uncertainty, concerns to some extent even with secrecy of managers and some information some needs of investors for information. Lastly, I talked about it with a CEO of a very large high-tech company in Boston. And he said, well, in addition to all the advantages that you mentioned, there is a huge advantage, internal advantage in this restatement, getting managers to think or to compare their prior expectations and what history basically tells you now. This kind of a continuous soul searching between expectation, realization of expectation, which usually leads to a new expectation, is going to be an important, that's what he said, is going to be an important internal information mechanism. So I started with the bad news, a significant decrease, as I see it, and I think it's backed by evidence of usefulness of key financial variables, be it earnings, cash flows, book values, not across the boards, but in major industries, which affects, of course, the entire picture. I focused on the major culprit in this case, and I didn't share with you much of the evidence that you'll find in the paper. For example, we have evidence there that the rate of change is fastly increasing. It's not just in my imagination, but we document this thing. So the culprit is change driven mainly by competition, innovation, deregulation, affecting the backbone of the accounting, or disrupting the backbone of the accounting measurement system. And I ended up with two proposals for change. Thank you very much.
Just a couple of minutes for questions. It's always very nice to hear that, for a British audience at least, that US accounting is not value relevant. So I think much of what you said has been welcomed here today. Are there any questions from the floor? Gentlemen at the back there. You'll have to speak up, I'm afraid. Or stand up.
Well, you're perfectly right that they don't do any R&D, and that's why I brought them. I didn't want to focus everything on R&D. I brought examples of change which is generated not by R&D, not by innovation, but comes from the outside, deregulation, and that's the telephone company example. Change that comes from competition restructuring, which in many cases also has nothing to do with R&D, and then change that comes from innovation. So R&D is not the only culprit, but just by its massive size, particularly in the United States, it's not across all firms, it's a major culprit in this thing. Well, who am I to argue with Bill Gates? So I'm definitely going to comment, and I don't even have the details of this thing. But Microsoft, as all of you know, has a very unique problem. They have too much cash. They generate $7-8 billion a year, and they have nothing to do with this money. They already repurchased all the stock that they can, because they cannot leave more than... they have to leave a few stocks in the stock market. And by antitrust, U.S. antitrust, they are prohibited from acquiring companies which are in their main business. So, you know, they go around, but I don't know. The one thing that I know is, and it doesn't pertain to this specific case of Microsoft, is that part of this, I would say, accounting craziness that goes on with respect to intangibles is particularly manifested in those acquisitions. And I have a paper which I called Flash and Flush, Flash with an A and then Flush with a U. And this characterizes, it will take a minute, this characterizes, describes an increasingly fast phenomenon in the United States, maybe in other countries too, in which companies, and I'll give you an example, IBM acquired Lotus in the third quarter of 95, paid $3.24 billion for Lotus. According to purchase accounting, you know, you have to value all the assets at fair market value. They value all the assets at fair market value, and of course, this would have provided them with a huge goodwill that they don't like to amortize, even if it's over 20, 30 years. So then they have a new asset which they call R&D in process, and they put a small value on R&D in process, $1.84 billion, which is 65% of the entire acquisition price. This is the flash. They flash the value in their financial report, and they say, no, we valued it according to present value, a whole page of explanation. Then they say, look at the 95 financial report of IBM. Then they say, we employed an internationally recognized appraisal company, which came with the same number, which I always find very suspicious. And so they flash this huge value, 65% of the entire acquisition price is for the R&D in process, and I don't contest it. I'm sure that they bought something in process. By then, they immediately flush the whole thing down the drain by immediately expensing the whole thing, using some kind of an obscure interpretation of an FASB statement, despite the fact that this is acquired R&D, not internally generated. And of course, they get the best of all worlds from it, because they showed a huge loss in the third quarter of 95. Investors didn't pay any attention to this. The larger the loss, the more nonchalant investors are. If the loss is small, it's alarming. If it's $2 billion, it's nothing in this case. And then after writing off 65% of the entire acquisition, any return that they'll get from Lotus, even small return, will be magnified three times because the denominator reflects just one-third of the investment in this case. And they just get the best of all worlds. So it's not just expensing of regular R&D. It's complete craziness. Firms go berserk in what they do in this area, which, of course, is reflected by this.
We have to stop there, but I'd like you all to thank Professor Baruch Leib for a very stimulating talk. Thank you.